The Guardian.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
The gold rush in Beijing is in full swing, but we're here to talk about another kind of games where it's Torres, not Phelps, who rules in the pool, and medals is Dr. Thaksin's job description. Plenty of surprises as the Premier League roars out of the blocks. Hull, Blackburn Rovers and Borough off to winning starts. A storming debut for Deco. Yet more problems for Man City and Newcastle in a not thrashed at Old Trafford shocker. Elsewhere, there's Bayern and the Bundesliga, plus all your questions on Fabio Capello's New England squad and the Championship answered by our team in today's Football Weekly. Off we go then on another voyage of discovery. On board today we have Jonathan Wilson.
Hello.
Critically acclaimed author of Inverting the Pyramid.
Thank you very much.
That's your new one.
Yes, History of Tactics, History of the Evolution of Tactics.
Yeah, well, it got some terrific write-ups there, Jonathan. Also, now on Sky Sport Exchange programme, which you'll have to tell us
Channel
about.
Channel 456.
There you go.
Or sportsexchange.tv.
Right, OK. Raphael, you're no stranger to the cathode ray, are you? Raphael
Hello.
Honigstein.
Hi.
Of, a burgeoning? Is it burgeoning or burgeoning? One of those media empires, though, anyway. Swiftly spreading, and of course of the Süddeutsche Zeitung when he's not talking about the Bundesliga on Setanta. And then we've got John Ashdown of GU Sports,
who's got no parochially
enough
or books to plug,
but is the winner of this week's Worst Way to Spend a Saturday award after spending 11 hours travelling to and from Bolton to see them play Stoke. Why, John?
11 and a half hours, James, right. It was in total. Why? Could go on a rant about National Rail, I think is probably the best way to describe it.
Right.
Travelling to Bolton via Sheffield, Manchester and a variety of other local stations was great fun.
I left the house at 8:45 to go to Hull, and I got back just after about 30 on Saturday. I think you had it.
Did you get it easy? Did you go Hull trains though?
I went Hull trains there, and I got a lift back with, unfortunately, a diabetic who had to stop for a meal on the way back, which is
that's your problem.
Why it took so long.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to mention about the game?
Well, from what I saw,
did you make it on time for kickoff?
I didn't make it on time for kickoff.
Oh, no way.
And I had to leave before the end.
So there was a plus to the day.
So there was that bonus. Yeah, there was that bonus. But what I did see, I quite enjoyed, because Bolton played jolly well and scored all three goals while I was there, which was quite nice. Johan Elmander, their record signing, played really well. Looked like a sort of souped-up Kevin Davies. If you imagine Kevin Davies with maybe a spoiler and go faster stripes, then that's Johan Elmander. Fabrice Muamba played really well in midfield. He's going to be an England international before too much longer, I think. And poor old Stoke, yeah, they were pretty dreadful.
Indeed so. Whereas their fellow newly promoted side, Hull, looked spiffing, didn't they, in their match against Fulham?
Yeah, it was a slightly odd game. I mean, Giovanni had a header for about 3 minutes, and Mark Schwarzer made an absolutely sensational save. And then I think Barmby following in was cleared by a combination of a post and John Painsill's shin. And I guess kind of thought then, well, is that the moment their fans are going to look back on and say, ah, oh, well, if that had gone in, the season would have been different. And for the next 20 minutes, they got absolutely battered by Fulham. He scored the one goal through Sol, but Simon Davis had a couple of very good chances. Zoltan Gehrer missed a very good chance. And then suddenly, from nothing, Giovanni scores. And the game flipped
goal,
on its head. Yeah, great goal.
Yeah.
And the game flipped on its head, and Hull thoroughly deserved the win in the end. Played very, very well second half. Phil Brown, I think, takes a lot of credit to the few substitutes he brought on in the second half. They were both involved in the second goal. He talked about the importance of them, do they play to his plan? And he said that, you know, they did play his plan, and that's why they won. So I think Phil Brown, you know, he's learnt from Sam Allardyce at Bolton, or possibly he was, you know, the power behind the throne at Bolton. We never quite know in those circumstances, but I think he's made a very impressive start. You know, certainly at home, I think Hull might be a difficult side to beat this season.
Giovanni as well. I mean, he came on a free, didn't he? So
I think he might have scored for Man City very early on last season.
He scored in his debut, and I think he scored maybe one more. I think he only had another two starts for them.
So,
but this is a player who, I mean, has now been widely pointed out. Barcelona once paid 18 million euros for him, was regarded as one of the rising stars of Brazilian football. Is this the moment when he resurrects his career?
Well, I mean, you look at his past history, I think the issue is, can he keep it going? And past history suggests no. But possibly at Hull, where he really is the main man, he really is the central figure there in terms of creativity. I mean, George Boateng, I thought, had a fantastic game at the back of the midfield. But you'd say, you know, Giovanni and Boateng were the two key players. Maybe, yeah, because he is the big fish there, he is having to drag everybody along. maybe that will keep him going a bit longer than he has done at other clubs.
Mm. Good start for Hull, though. They've got, I think, Rovers, is it next, and then Wigan after that. So potential to continue that, although Rovers were one of the big surprises as well with that 3-2 at Everton, not least because they came back from 2-1 down. I don't know if anyone actually caught this game, but Paul Ince in a fantastic debut in the Premier League.
No, I missed match of the day because I was coming back from Hull.
All right, well, it was all very, very impressive because the pre-game build-up was all about how Rovers were in a bit of a mess. Ince's techniques weren't going to work out with Premier League footballers, etc. But it seemed to be a very tight ship he was running. And as I say, heads didn't go down when they went 2-1 behind.
But there is a general issue here, isn't there? That kind of grade B side, the kind of teams who you'd hope would be challenging to get into the top four, of them, only Villa won. The rest all had pretty disappointing first games. Your Man City well beaten, Tottenham losing at Middlesbrough, Everton losing at home, a game, as you say, against a team that kind of we thought mightn't be quite as strong as they were last season. Portsmouth, you're absolutely hopeless yesterday against Chelsea.
Boy.
So yeah, you do think that's the top four, but not even being challenged now.
What about Villa then? Because it was a hugely impressive performance, albeit against a Man City side that's in real trouble right now. And problems continue with Valery Bojanov, who managed to get injured, 6 minutes into his first start in the Premier League last season. This time didn't even wait around for that, just went straight out and ruptured his Achilles tendon, was it, in the warm-up? And he's going to be out for another 6 months or so. Poor old Mark Hughes, who signed on amid talk of Ronaldinho and the like coming to Eastlands, now finds himself with Ched Evans, who had never made a Premier League appearance until this weekend. And everyone else is either at the Olympics or out injured.
Yeah, you look down their first 11 and there's nothing there. It doesn't look like a Premier League side. And for a team that kind of, in my mind, I was kind of classing them as that grade B side, the team just doesn't look like that.
I think Mark Hughes and a lot of the people at City really rate young Ched Evans, but it's quite a tough place to go on the opening day of the season for your debut.
But he's a player to be brought in, kind of coming off the bench, kind of bring him in gradually. I mean, and defensively they were shocking. I mean, those like Bonlahor goals, the defending was just pathetic. Mm. Mm.
7 minutes and a hat trick, magnificent stuff. Did you see this, Rafael?
Just sort of goes, but I wanted to make a point about Mark Hughes. I was just wondering at what point he'll become a little bit political, because he's a very young, upcoming manager, you know, tipped for many great things, and obviously he signed up with the idea of increasing his credentials. But if they really are going to completely disintegrate, I think they'll have to come to a point, and then probably come very quickly, we'll have to make a decision. Otherwise, he'll be tainted with that disastrous experience that City are having again. So
you mean
I think
he can't afford to stay there too long?
If they continue on this path, and if the problems at the back can continue, and you know, there's all sorts of things that haven't even been written about cash flow problems, etc., he'll have to make the decision pretty soon to get out. And I think that, you know, that would obviously put the nail in the coffin for City, because no one half decent would then touch them either. So I think that they're in for a really rocky ride.
He's got problems as well, because the Mexico job's already gone to Sven. So
that's right.
It's going to be tough. What about Shinawatra? Because he's now on the run, technically, I think, isn't he?
He's fighting extradition proceedings. So
right, okay.
Term.
And having skipped bail, excitingly enough, with his wife, the Premier League now have to, if he's found guilty of buying government land in an illegal fashion. What happens with this whole fit and proper person thing?
I think it's very difficult for football, because if this were any other business, you couldn't stop somebody buying the business unless they had a criminal conviction. So as soon as they have a criminal conviction, then you have an issue. But I'm not sure that the Premier League can suddenly say, well, you've got to relinquish that club.
One thing to stop him actually buying it, but now he's got it. How are they going to take it back off?
I mean, it's a regular thing of kind of people who want to kind of give football a bit of a kicking, to say that, you know, look at all these terrible people who are in charge of clubs. Well, all those people in charge of clubs own other businesses as well, and they cannot be stopped from doing it. If the Premier League tried to stop them, they'd be facing a lawsuit they have no chance of winning.
Mm.
So the fit and proper person test is a bit of a farce, to be honest. I mean, what can they do? The Premier League's not bigger than the stock exchange. It's not bigger than the law. I don't see what the Premier League can do to stop people owning clubs. But if there is a conviction, what can they do to get taxing out? I just don't really see how it can work.
Is there any chance of the Thai government seizing Stephen Ireland as one of Thaksin's assets at all?
Not if Roy Keane's got nothing to do with it.
Of course, we haven't touched on the big four yet, but we'll do that in a minute or two. Rafael Honigstein, you spent a very pleasant Sunday afternoon at Stamford Bridge witnessing Chelsea dismantle Portsmouth 4-0.
Indeed, I can't entertain you with any glorious anecdotes about trips to exciting, exotic places, but the short tube ride to Stamford Bridge was very uneventful, and the game was worthwhile for it, at least the first half when there was a resemblance of resistance from Pompey. But Chelsea were very impressive. They always had this power that we've seen from them for the last few years, but they had a bit more composure this time, and they passed the ball really well. They kept it a lot better, and they were very incisive every time they went forward. So very, very impressed with them, notwithstanding the fact that they have Nicholas Anelka up there, who looked half decent, but you just wonder and you question his commitment and his hunger. And I think even Scolari, though he was very complimentary in the press conference, I think is not entirely quite sure about him either. So that would be my one question mark behind Chelsea, but otherwise a near perfect
Decker,
performance.
Decker, how good was he?
He was good. I don't think he was man of the match. I don't think he really dominated proceedings that much. There were a lot of lofty balls that went over the head of fullbacks from him. But he was very good, and he rattled in that goal in the end. I think that might have tipped it. For me, the best player on the pitch, or certainly the most consistent player, was John Obi Mikello, or Michael, or whatever his real name is. He was very, very good.
Jonathan, step in, please.
His name's Michael John Obi. His father was a goalkeeper called John Obi. He's got a brother called something John Obi. He went to Scandinavia Youth Tournament. They misspelled Michael as Mikel. He liked Mikel. He's taken Mikel for his name on his shirt. His name's Mikel John Obi, or Michael John Obi, if you prefer.
Uh-huh.
But Mikel is his kind of shirt name. And Obi is his family name.
I'm glad we cleared that up.
Well, I am too. Thank you for that, Jonathan.
It's a pleasure.
The fullbacks were allowed a lot of freedom to go forward, and Pompey were nowhere near them. I mean, they couldn't contain them, and they were absolutely useless.
Just a question on that point about the fullbacks. I mean, do you think they could be a bit narrow through midfield if the fullbacks don't get forward? Are they reliant on the fullbacks for width?
They are, because they're playing without wide midfielders as such. I mean, Joe Cole had license to roam a bit, and Deco was ostensibly on the left, but they were all over the place, and you don't have a natural width unless the fullbacks come forward. I think it's very exciting, and I think Chelsea fans, including a certain Mr. Abramovich, would be very encouraged by that.
Well,
he
was beaming. Of course, although the points will count come the end of the season, any other conclusions we draw from the opening day do run the risk of looking very, very silly within even a month or two. Jonathan, you have...
Did you think that David James was particularly poor on Sunday? I thought the second goal, he came charging up his goal needlessly. I thought the fourth goal he could have done better on.
I think the fourth goal, they could have given to him as an own goal. People were blinded by the beauty of the shot from Deco, but the fact it went to the top corner is because James pushed it there. It was actually more or less going straight at him. And I think, he got a very good hand to it and he should have saved it.
But I just think that second goal, he had no need to come... If the cross comes over, there was a defender there. He didn't have to go charging out and he had no chance of getting there. It gave Anelka a very simple nodding at overline of 2 yards. I don't quite understand why opinion on David James is going to turn full circle. We're now back to saying he's comfortably the greatest. Well, maybe he is comfortably the best English keeper, but that's a terrible indictment
of
other
English keepers. He's not really looking that, and he never has looked that reliable. You've got Joe Hart. Who else is there? Paul Robinson's in the England squad. We'll be looking at this a bit later on, but who else would you?
Well, I mean, Robinson, as Sean keeps on saying, he's got a terrible issue with his footwork, and that's an issue with coaching. Why hasn't that been coached out of him? He's very sluggish on his feet. He gets beaten from long range all the time. And as his confidence has gone, his judgment on crosses has gone as well. But I mean, it's a technical issue with Robinson's feet. I don't know, Rob Green, Chris Kirkland, if he stays fit. I don't know, I think we have got a big problem in that
area. It is a big problem.
I'm just slightly bewildered that David James is now seen as being the out-and-out number one, when I think there's kind of just a real mess, and it's not obvious who it should be. I've also got an issue with David James over the foul on Kenwyn Jones and the friendly against Trinidad and Tobago, which is a terrible foul. And I say this as a Sunderland fan, obviously.
Right.
But still, he comes flying out of his goal, 40 yards out of his goal, clatters him knee-high. I'm not even sure it was a free kick, was it?
There you go. Now, Sir Alex Ferguson will be very upset if we don't get on to Manchester United at this point. They failed to continue their recent spree against the Magpies. A 1-1 draw, the result at Old Trafford between United and United. And you have to say, Newcastle could even have won this game, couldn't they?
Yeah, it was quite refreshing, really, after the procession of the Chelsea game earlier on in the afternoon, when you just thought, oh, God, here we go again. It's big four all the way. And Newcastle put in a great performance. I thought it was quite ironic that it's probably one of those things that you say is ironic that isn't ironic. Ferguson for years has gone on about getting 7 subs on the bench, and if you look at some of the names that were down there, he was struggling to fill those
places. Who did he have, John?
Well, according to our paper this morning, he had a guy called Possibon, who I think is either Rafael or Robinho, or one of the two Brazilian fellas, and an R. da Silva, which is the other one of Rafinha,
right,
and Robinho. There was an Evans, a Gibson, a Neville. I don't know this Neville character. I've not seen him for a long time.
No. But,
it was he didn't have many options to turn to, and he started off with Fraser Campbell up front, who I do think is a good player, but it's a big ask opening day of the season.
Yeah, there were various exotic teenagers wandering onto the pitch at points of the afternoon. As I say, it is always dangerous to draw conclusions. United had a very slow start last year, although perhaps the fact that Chelsea were in turmoil at various points of the season allowed them to get away with that. And this year, we may well see Chelsea racing out of the trap and not letting United have too much chance to get back into it. United as well looking flat without Ronaldo. Ronaldo will be back, what, in a month or so, we think, from the Angle operation?
No Tevez as well.
No Tevez, of course, which all explains why this Berbatov move is still very much a possibility. And Berbatov, in fact, today saying, I'm still a Tottenham player, but no one can disagree with me wanting to follow my dream. Two clubs haggling over a fee in the region of 25 to 28 million. Is this one going to go through, Raphael?
I think so. Yeah. I think it's clearly about money. Usually when it's about money, a solution is being found, especially when the difference is so narrow. I mean, 3 million here or there is really nothing, I think. It's just Tottenham doing the thing that they should do and don't do often enough, in my view, and was just hold their ground a little bit longer and then sell when the other side is more desperate.
Am I hearing that Michael Owen might be their potential replacement for Dimitar Berbatov?
That was a rumour over the weekend, certainly, yeah. Well, it's a slightly strange one in that it looks as though Juan de Ramos wants to play either 4-3-3-1 or 4-1-4-1, given he's packed the team with people like Giovanni and Modric and David Bentley. He's got Aaron Lennon there as well. And you have huge numbers of attacking midfielders. So if you're playing one up front, it's got to be somebody with a bit of presence about him, somebody can hold the ball up,
right?
Like Berbatov, which I guess Darren Bent can do, but I think they need somebody better in that mould.
Yeah.
And Michael Owen just isn't that player.
Well, there you go.
As well as the whole Berbatov thing rumbles on, it gives Tottenham less and less time to find somebody to replace before the end of August.
I mean, the issue with Ashavin and Pavlyuchenko, which now seems that both are, I mean, Pavlyuchenko's kind of said quite clearly he doesn't want to go, and he's been very clear about that for the last month. You know, Shavin clearly does want to leave Zenit. You do wonder whether Zenit's terrible league form has got something to do with that. He's thinking, actually, this glorious Champions League swan song to my career in Russia is going to be pretty embarrassing and not that glorious at all. But, I mean, Ashavin doesn't solve that problem either. No, he's another one to play in that role behind the frontman.
Meantime, also in the top four, Arsenal, Nasri settled in very, very quickly and not much else happened in that game. Is that right? 1-0 win over West Brom?
More or less right.
Right, OK. Terms, yeah. Liverpool, a 1-0 win at Sunderland. Interesting that the player who Rafa apparently wanted to sell, Xavi Alonso, looked very good when he came on, and the player who Rafa did buy for $20 million managed to get in the way quite a lot. Although there was no ill feeling. It was nice to see that Torres and Robbie Keane gave each other the high five, etc., after Robbie had stood in the path of really, Torres' goal-bound shot.
Really rubbish thing to do, though, wasn't it? Torres' goal was my favourite goal of the weekend. I thought it was an absolute belter. It was superb.
Just wondering what's really wrong with Xabi Alonso and Rafa, that he's been so open about wanting to get rid of him. I mean, even
well,
if
actually,
you do, this is you shouldn't do it because obviously it drives down
it?
The... Yeah, I mean, he's been...
He said on Friday, he said that this hasn't been him doing this Xavi Alonso business. All the talk about Xavi Alonso, everyone says it's to do with Benitez, but he hasn't spoken, he says, to anyone at Aston Villa about Barry and consequently about getting rid of Xavi Alonso. He also said about talking to Arsenal about Xavi Alonso since April. He says everyone blames him for everything from, what is it, rising petrol prices to global warming,
yeah,
etc.
But is that why he picked Plessis ahead of Xabi Alonso at the beginning of the game?
No, you're absolutely right. There is clearly
something wrong, and you just wonder why and how. Why is he handling it that way? Because they tried to sell him to Juventus. It fell through because of price. If you've, as a manager, made up your mind of selling a player, the last thing you want to do is making that fact very public and driving down the price.
Mm.
And it might backfire spectacularly if, of course, the Gareth Barry move doesn't go through and you're stuck with a player who you very clearly... Well, I wouldn't say offended, but, show that you'd rather be without him. So I think it's a strange man management. And, of course, the thing rumbling in the background, the white elephant, as it were, in the room, is that the fact that he's still very unhappy that he's not getting the financial backing from the backers.
Mm.
He didn't want to explicitly attack the owners for not giving the money. So he said, you have to talk to Rick Perry. He'll tell you why we don't have the money, why the money's in there. But... Yeah, he made the point very forcefully.
He plays a very clever political game, doesn't he, Benitez? And he's constantly going on with these machinations, kind of blaming Hicks, blaming Gillette, blaming Parry. And given what happened to Valencia, the fact he fell out so badly with the board there, you do wonder whether actually Benitez is the man to blame. And what you see all the time is he's very, very careful in these kind of rants at people like Parry, just to drop in the line going how much he loves the fans at Liverpool and, oh, yeah, great to play at Anfield, just to make sure they are still on board.
It does seem like a situation that's heading towards untenability, if it's not quite there yet. But anyway, there you go. Very good. Well, that's the Premier League, the first weekend of action. And we've got the first weekend of action from the Bundesliga coming up in a second with Raphael Honigstein.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Now, plenty of people posting in asking for more Raphael Honigstein this year. And Raphael, you're a busy guy, but I'm delighted that you've chosen to rejoin us again today. And why don't you tell us about the exciting first weekend's events in the Bundesliga?
It was very exciting because we had loads of goals. Had
Bayern, they went 2-0 up and then got paid
up
back.
After, I think, 16 minutes or something like that. And
by Martin Jol's Hamburg.
Yeah, unbelievable result. Even though Hamburg were well worth it and perhaps even a better side. And Klinsmann already after one game under serious pressure because he'd come in saying, oh, I'm going to improve all the players. We're going to show more exciting football. But, of course, result is what really matters. And 2-2 after an early 2-0 lead, seen as really not good enough and serious questions about the defending and some of the players already coming out the woodwork and saying we're not well organised, all the defenders thinking about attacking, etc.
They didn't wait long.
They were just being honest. I mean, the organisation wasn't there. Every time Hamburg attacked, they looked like scoring. And this is no way to go about a season, especially if, like Bayern, you have one eye of having a bit of an impact in the Champions League. I think they'll be torn apart if they play with that sort of gung-ho style.
My word.
Much more positive note, Hoffenheim,
yes,
who've already been mentioned, who are always going to be the most interesting story this season because there's this tiny, tiny place, 3,300 inhabitants, who are suddenly in the Bundesliga after six promotions, thanks to 200-odd euro millions from their wealthy benefactor, Dietmar Hopp, who is a software tycoon in Germany and used to play for them when he was an amateur. What have they done? Of course, they won the first game 3-0 away to Cottbus, and they're at top of the league, tied with Schalke, who had the same result. Part of the reason why Dietmar Hopp decided to invest there is because there is no natural big club in the area, and he thought, we'll put a big club there, we'll get some of the locals who've got nothing else to do on a Saturday coming along. And it seems to work because they've sold 13,000 season tickets. And the village, I hesitate to say city, only has 3,000-odd inhabitants. So it's a big story. And funnily enough, in the Bundesliga, you know, money is the root of all envy. They've already made that a big issue. The bigger clubs are not very happy. You know, upstarts coming, spending quite big bucks on very young, talented Brazilians. They haven't gone out and bought big stars. They invested very smartly in new and up-and-coming talent. And hey, presto, there are forced to be reckoned
with. Well, I can understand people's disquiet about this, because if you think about the kind of controversy that surrounded Roman Abramovich's takeover and the way he artificially, if you like, beefed up Chelsea with his money, it's a kind of almost like a GM approach to the growth of football clubs. And suddenly, kind of injecting this massive amount of cash into the middle of the German countryside. And what happens if he then loses interest and dies or both?
In the manner of Gretna, you mean?
Exactly. Well, that was the thought.
His defence is that they haven't just gone and bought, you know, the best 10 players in the Bundesliga and spend wild money. They've built an academy. They put in structures into place where Hoffenheim will be able to create its own players. It's all based on the Arsenal Academy model. Ralf Rangnick, the manager, was actually an intern at Wenger for a while, looked at everything he was doing and replicating a lot of it. And they're saying, you know, we're doing this from the ground up, and he's also putting money in hospitals, etc. So that's his defence. Of course, it's a very volatile business model if you're dependent on a benefactor. But, you know, it's worked for a long time in Italy for many clubs.
Well, there you go. Thank you very much, Raphael. How about the Championship? Plenty of interesting tales from England's second tier, John, this weekend. A Red Devil who missed?
Yeah, that was up at Turf Moor in Burnley. The Red Devils parachutist display group were bringing the match ball down to the pitch, and one of their number, probably the trainee maybe, or the guy who was perhaps learning the ropes a little bit, got caught on the top of the stand, which is called the David Fishwick stand, which is such a place to get caught on. And they delayed the match for 55 minutes while various stewards and groundspeople tried to get him down. I believe he wasn't carrying the ball. He was just one of the sort of auxiliary delivery men.
Could they not have just left him there and got on with the game?
Possibly. He would have had a great view. But Burnley have got a history, a previous with this pre-game entertainment in sort of, in quotes. December last year, they had a blimp, a Burnley blimp. The chairman said was just for pre-game entertainment for the people of Burnley to look at. Right. And it was there for an hour and a half outside the ground before vandals released it. Ah. From its bounds, and the poor old blimp was sent floating away, and Burnley and the local police made various heartfelt pleas for its safe return.
Oh dear, is Burnley quite a quiet town? If a blimp is
this is the thing. Yeah, it's there's not a lot going on there. I don't think so. The blimps are just sort of, you know, wow, what on earth is that?
We do a very good pie and peas before kickoff, though, don't they?
I've actually, but Seth was one of the few grounds I've never been to.
And they lost 3-0 to Ipswich.
They did, yeah, and they were my sort of pre-season tips for dark horses. No, Burnley.
Oh dear.
And they've lost 3-0 and 4-1, I think. Well, they've lost heavily both games, but the Championship does this every year. You sort of make these pre-season ideas and say, "Oh, they'll do all right." And who's top of the league? Two wins out of two, Coventry and Preston. It's crazy.
It is crazy. What about QPR? Because they're kind of one of the logical teams to think they're going to do really well.
Well, they're everybody's sort of hate figure this year. It's quite strange how much sort of,
because of the artificial injection of massive cash.
Well, they're the richest team in the world. In one sense, and they got stuff this week at beautiful downtown Bramall Lane. Billy Sharp scoring a hat-trick there in 50 minutes. And Ian Dowie, the QPR manager, was very unhappy with the way his team defended set pieces and how they failed to compete. And he had to warn one of their Argentinian, I think, midfielders,
Ledesma,
for his sort of play-acting and his theatrics. It's exactly what I think QPR fans were fearing before the season started. They'd brought in these couple of Italians there now, this Argentinian guy. And it's going up to the sort of northern grounds but it's still August, isn't it? So it's not like it's the depth of winter, but trying to grind out results. And to be honest, the team that they've got, I don't think they're capable of making the playoffs. Sheffield United, on the other hand, they played reasonably well away at Birmingham opening game of the season. Apparently, I didn't see the game, but they looked pretty good on Saturday. Birmingham are another team who started really well, thanks to the evergreen Kevin Phillips. Last second winner last week, 77th minute winner this week. Both of them are coming off the bench. And he just keeps doing it. It's incredible.
Still to come in today's Football Weekly, we're going to have a quick look through your posts and look forward to the big friendly round of fixtures that are coming up mid-week. Now, your posts. Plenty of you managed to find the best efforts of the Guardian's website, notwithstanding our preview show on Friday, and have been posting in with responses and stuff, etc. If you've got any comments about this show and indeed or any other,
guardian.co.uk
/football
/football weekly
perhaps
Football Weekly, yeah. You might be able to click on the link that says Football
it's not
Weekly
address,
yeah.
Though,
yeah.
Is it?
Isn't it?
No.
Alright then, anyway, good luck with that one. Tempton the Rat says Kevin Keegan and Newcastle take a lot of stick from Football Weekly, but even Barry Glendinning would have to salute them after their performance. They were magnificent, fully deserved that point at Old Trafford. Fair enough, Templeton the Rat. Barry will be back on Thursday, no doubt, full of compliments for the Magpies. Private Dick says, he's concerned about the fact that Serie A, it looks like, won't be televised in Britain this season. I find this incredible, says Private Dick, given that Bundesliga, League One and various other things get on various cable channels.
Ligue 1,
you're right. Le Championnat.
Brazilian football on Sports Exchange, channel 456.
some Japanese football. Where's the Bundesliga, Rafa?
Setanta.
While we're on the subject of Italy, I should just briefly stop to pay respects to Franco Sensi, the man who made Roma great again, who died on Sunday after a long illness. He was 82. He was the guy who basically came in 1993 when Roma were really on their uppers. The guy used to run them, a complete crook called Ciarapico, was on his way to prison, and the club were in all sorts of financial difficulty, and Sensi and another guy came in and bankrolled them and poured money in, and Sensi indeed continued doing this, selling off various other parts of his family's business empire to finance the club when the income started to run dry after the turn of the century. But in the meantime, he'd managed to take them to their third Scudetto ever, their first in two decades, bring in Fabio Capello and make him the best paid manager in the world with that in mind, and really brought around about a renaissance of Roman football, and I think creating one of the most attractive football teams anywhere in Europe. Roma have played some absolutely phenomenal football, especially under Spalletti in later years. It bears mentioning that he hasn't actually been in control of the club since 2004 because of his illnesses. His daughter, Rossella, has been taking care of that. But anyway, a great big salute to Franco Sensi, who was a real character and put together a heck of a football team. Tim R2000 says, will the Football Weekly be having a league in the new and improved, also accurate and serious Guardian Footy Fantasy League? Yes, we do, John.
We do, yes.
It's called Football Weekly. And the password, as last week's listeners will recall, is Pod Almighty, or one word, Pod Almighty.
That's the one.
I had some good picks this weekend. Have you guys got teams?
Not in this league, no, it's far too complex.
Oh, okay.
I've got a team. We didn't have a good weekend, we didn't have a good start. I think the key is to pick players who are actually going to play.
Right.
So, you know, there's an element of that, and I failed to do that in several cases.
Do join in, listeners, because it's great fun. Wee Genie, interesting one, this. At first, I had no idea what crews look like, Football Weekly crews, that is, apart from Jimbo. He's got a good memory. I used my imagination and conjured up some images that I thought matched voices. And he gives us, for our information, his images of us Pobsters. He has me as Gavin Peacock. That's kind of pointless, isn't it? But anyway, Fernando Duarte like Eduardo. Rafael Honigstein, you look like Roger Federer in this man's head. If you want to get across Setanta's Bundesliga coverage, you'll see your illusions shattered in the worst way. So stay away from that, Wigini. Nobody for you, Jonathan. I'm sorry about that. There's nobody here. Or you, John Ashton.
I think can I go for a young Brian Blessed?
I think you can. For yourself?
Yes, not for anybody else.
All right, then. I could go for a young Brian.
Young George Orwell? I've been compared to him before.
Well, really?
Not facially, not writingly.
What kind of people do you hang out with, Jonathan?
Weirdos.
Right.
Left-wing nuts.
And Sean Ingle, Russell Howard from Mott the Week. I'm not familiar with him, but Sean Ingle is Lamar, and Lamar is Sean Ingle. There's not much question about that. Kevin McCarra, Gordon Strachan, Paul Doyle, Lee Dixon, that one does. If you've ever seen Paul Doyle, that's going to trouble you. Yeah, they couldn't be more different. And Barry Glendinning, and Greg Proops from Whose Line Is It Anyway?
But Kevin actually looks very like Pat Nevin.
Well, there you go.
Very like him.
Yeah. That's all for the posting, but do send in any messages and questions, etc. you might have. Friendly's coming up, Jonathan. You were just telling me all sorts of interesting facts about this. Italy, for example, are playing Austria, and that's Marcello Lippi's first game in charge.
And Carol Bruckner's first game in charge of Austria.
Because he's come across from the Czechs.
Yeah, who will play England with Petr Rada, their new coach. Brought in two uncapped players in the squad, Jan Reinok and Michael.
Oh, you're going to tell us about the Czechs?
I made some notes just in case you asked me. Papadopoulos spent 3 years in Germany, which Rafael, I'm sure, will be able to tell us a bit. But he scored his first goal for Mladá Boleslav on Saturday, having moved back to the Czech Republic.
Right, OK. Apart from him, anybody we should be watching out for?
Well, Jan Koller's retired, so not him.
Right. Is Milan Baroš still in the squad?
He is, and Radek Šerl's come back in, the Zenit St. Petersburg full-back come midfielder.
Mm. The Czechs are taking on England, who will feature who? What do we want to talk about the England squad, John?
Emil Heskey, maybe.
Emil Heskey is in there. Dean Ashton, who looked like being the call-up with his two goals.
Yeah, I got told off at the weekend watching Match of the Day with my other half. I laughed when Dean Ashton shanked that free kick horribly over the bar and injured himself, ruled himself out. I mean, what a way to rule, you know, score two proper good goals.
Yeah.
And then do
with
that.
Capello watching in
absolutely,
the stands.
Yeah. And then to launch a...
It's
40
not funny,
yard free
the poor
kick.
Guy.
Yeah,
you know,
well,
he come back from all those injuries.
Half shouting me about. Yeah, yeah. I didn't feel particularly guilty, but I didn't get my full plate of chips that night. That's
sorry to hear that. Is that a metaphor?
That wasn't a euphemism, though.
Oh, okay. Okay. Ashley Young, not included. Nor was Agbong Lahore. That was obviously before, I think the squad was announced before yesterday's game. Peter Crouch, not called up. Nor was Tottenham striker Darren Bent. Beckham is in the squad.
I think the Beckham thing is almost, it's getting to the point where it could even be slightly political again, in that to drop him now makes a statement in the similar way to when McLaren dropped him and made a statement, and it didn't exactly work out well for second choice Steve. So you do sort of wonder if Capello's slightly reticent to get shut of him and have that sort of focus on that big decision, and only to later on having to perhaps resort to him once more.
Later on.
My word.
Well, the one thing you can't say about Beckham...
Can you really, sorry, Jonathan, can you really see him playing in 2010 for England in South Africa?
Well, assuming England get to South Africa.
This is what I was about to say, though, that kind of Beckham will get you goals, but he won't make you play good football. So the question is, are you going for the team that, that actually kind of plays cohesively and plays well? Or are you going for a team that, you know, wins games? He's a very useful player to have to bring on with 20, 25 minutes to go, and you know his delivery from corners will be excellent. You know his delivery from free kicks will be excellent. If you've got Crouch or Heskey or Ashton or a good head of the ball, John Terry coming up from the back, then that suddenly gives England a very kind of powerful weapon. I do think, especially international defences, are vulnerable to dead balls because they don't have enough time to train together to get the marking sorted. It's almost like hockey when you bring on the penalty corner specialist. I think Beckham, as an option late in a game, can be a useful weapon. But he shouldn't start. And I don't understand why Ashley Young's not in the squad. I think he had a great season last season. He's quick, he can cross the ball. More assists than anybody else last season. And I mean, it's not like England have kind of got thousands of left-sided midfielders he's got to get past. I find that slightly odd.
Should we mention Wales-Georgia, I suppose, just for political reasons?
Yes, we should. Yeah. Just because Wales-Georgia.
It'll have far more media attention on it than it would usually have.
Didn't Georgia absolutely batter Wales in the early 90s under Mike Smith? It was like Mike Smith's last game as well.
They could have done, Jonathan, yeah. I'll leave that one to your expert knowledge on that, I don't know.
Good. I think that pretty much brings us to the end of our little mission. So many, many thanks, Jonathan, for beaming up today. And you too, Raphael. And John, yourself.
Thank you.
And I hope the rest of your week goes smoothly and you have no more troubles, any of you, with your transport, etc. We will be returning on Thursday, looking forward to the weekend's events. And hopefully you'll be joining us for that, listeners. In the meantime, from all of us here, it is goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.